Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And I'm pre-recording because I'm going to be away on a legal case doing what I can do on behalf of individuals who may have been injured by psychiatry. And my guest is a really an interesting man, someone that I met a few months ago, maybe a year, actually it was a couple of years ago originally, but I've gotten to know better and better in the last few months. His name is Thomas Garcia. Tom is from Florida. He's on the board of the Florida Adlerian Society. He's a mental health counselor. He's in Florida. He's going for his PhD. He's in the Tampa area. He is doing his doctoral studies at USF, and he is nonetheless an adjunct professor already at Springfield College. And last March, when I spoke at the Adlerian Society of Florida, I met a bunch of Thomas's students, and they just love him. They just think he is a marvelous teacher, which makes me think we're going to have a marvelous radio show. And I invited him to do presentations, my wife Ginger and I, at our last two empathic therapy conferences. By the way, we will have an empathic therapy conference next April, 26, 27, 28, which we expect to fill. We just have been very close to filling, and we think we may fill. So sign up ahead of time. And my own class that I was teaching, graduate students in counseling, were required to go to the conference, and five of them went to the workshop, the breakout workshop that Tom did on Adlerian psychology, and pronounced it the best thing at the conference. Now, I don't know if they meant even better than mine, but they didn't say, you know, next to yours, Peter, the best. They said it was the best thing we went to. Four out of five. And the fifth thought it was marvelous, but there was just too much information. A bit of an older student, maybe, not used to the pace of new learning. Tom is also a clinical director of Novus Detox and Suncoast Rehabilitation in Tampa. I'll let him tell you about that. Our focus today, although I'm sure we'll stray wildly, is going to be Adlerian psychology. Hello, Tom Garcia.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Well, I'm just really good. I'm delighted to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for filling in at the last minute. I thought it's got to be a good friend I call at the last minute, and you are a good, dear friend. Tom, you want to start anywhere in particular?
Well, fill-ins always do well. I remember when Buster Mathis in the, I think it was the 1964 Olympics, decided that he got hurt, and Joe Frazier took in and won the gold medal. So I'm okay to filling in these things. So.
And Buster Mathis, by the way, the first person to beat, what's his name? Oh, my gosh, I'm blocking on his name. You know, the great ferocious fighter who was knocking out everybody in the first round.
Oh, no, that was Buster Douglas.
That was Buster Douglas.
February 11th, 1990, I believe, in Tokyo, Japan. I was still working media back then, and so that's why, you know, it's amazing I remember these dates for some
odd reason. Well, help me with my name failing, because I just watched him on television. The boxer that Buster beat.
Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson, of course.
Right from Catskills, New York, not too far from...
I said we might go astray, but this is going to be, this current discussion, Tom, this is going to be too much for a lot of our
guests. No, of course.
So let's... I mean, we probably did dropping like flies thinking we're going to talk about boxing and sports.
No. Well, I did compare psychiatry to professional wrestling, but we'll talk about that some other time.
All right. What about, I'm going to have to take charge, obviously. What about Adlerian psychology? What did you tell my students that they thought was so informative?
Well, you know, Alfred Adler, over 100 years ago, you know, really said that the reason why people get into trouble, and back then his term was origins of neurosis, was that people don't know how to get along with each other. They just don't have the skills or the means to deal with people. And Adler believed that the root of all people's problems are this unequal distribution of power. And Adler talked about will to power more like the individual's empowering, I think, is more. Although at the time, a lot of Adler's theories were rooted in some of Nietzsche's work, which were published decades earlier. But Adler meant that people can become empowered, a will to power. He had concepts like overcompensation for deficits, perceived deficits. Adler was an ophthalmologist. He was a physician who opted to work in one of the poor sections of Vienna. And he was one of the very first individuals, and this is when in the late 1800s, 1890s, to deal with people with disabilities. He was an advocate for women's rights, and he really advocated for women's ditching their husbands, overpowering husbands. And in those days, they had a diagnosis called hysteria. Women got sick of their overbearing husbands and decided to do something about it. Adler was a most amazing individual who was an incredible influence on the likes of Carl Rogers and Albert Ellis, Bill Glasser.
And Peter Bregan, me too.
Yeah, and
I read a lot of Adler when I was young. Wasn't assigned in class, but I read a lot of his books.
And it's sad. It's really sad because, you know, the trend of mental health counseling and psychology is toward cognitive behavioral therapy because it's billable and it's very fashionable. And it's a shame that Adler is overlooked. I had a student the other a couple weeks ago. Oh, yes, Alfred Adler. Wasn't he one of Freud's pupils? No, he was not Freud's pupils. He was a contemporary of Freud. Freud had asked him to join the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, which Adler later on left, as well as did Carl Jung. And it's amazing that people just don't realize that Adlerian individual psychology really hones in on an individual's sense of belongingness and their social interests. He had a term called Gemeinschaftsgefühl, social interest. How vested are people into their community? And as you know, when you give children psychotropic medications, especially psychomotor stimulants, the first thing that goes is social interest, and they isolate. It's incredible that Adler talked about this over 100 years ago, and it's ignored.
So on the one hand, Adler's talking about a kind of perverted will to power that comes as a compensation for the feelings. I remember he talked about feelings of inferiority or feelings of inadequacy. But then more and more, he's saying that that's, you know, that's peripheral to the real issue, which is the fact that we're social beings and we need to relate to each other, care about each other, and build families and communities together, and that when that gets distorted, when the social interest gets distorted, you get what looks like psychiatric symptoms. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, what Adler called psychosis. You know, he really argued for holism. You know, he viewed the individual as a holistic being. Frankl, prior to his incarceration during the war, read on Alfred Adler. In his logotherapy, he was given tribute to Alfred Adler. And it's just incredible. In his will to power, Adler really meant that you individual focuses on creative power to make changes for the better. And it's just really, really incredible when you read Adler's early work, and of course the translations of Dreikers and Ansbacher, and just over the years of people that have just adopted Adler's way.
Don't assume people know who any of these people are. Ansbacher a book that I read as a college freshman or sophomore on my own was Ansbacher and Ansbacher's book on the selections from Alfred Adler, which is a marvelous way to begin learning, because Adler wrote in a lot of different books and his style was kind of discursive, I guess, at times. And they really put together his ideas and evaluate his ideas, and it's a very helpful introduction into what is a very modern approach, which is that we emphasize developing the social aspect of the child or the adult who's very interested in children. Let me know if I'm off base. And then you mentioned Dreikers, and he's a psychiatrist, I think, right, who wrote about Adler.
Yep, he was one of Adler's, studied with Adler and finished when Adler died on May 28th, I believe 1937, in Aberdeen, Dreikers, or May 28, 37, Dreikers finished the lecture tour that Adler was doing. And one of the most incredible quotes of Dreikers, as far as dealing with children, we cannot protect our children from life, therefore it is important that we prepare them for it. I find that so powerful, so wonderful that the parents sometimes, when they decide to go to psychiatry to help parent their children, they seem to forget of all these notions that we've had for hundreds and hundreds, hundreds of years. They just get forgotten.
Well, say more about that, about those notions we've forgotten.
Well, that children need a sense of belonging, and they need a sense of importance, a sense of significance. And, you know, we've known this for almost at least 100 years, especially when it comes to parenting children. You know, it's important. And the basics, you just generally care for your child, act in your child's best interest, separate parental, current, and unfulfilled self-esteem issues that a lot of parents, again, I see this as a psychotherapist, and they have a very difficult time separating these unfulfilled self-esteem issues from their child's. And I've seen that many pounds ago in athletics, when I would just see parents push their children toward sports, gymnastics. My sport was boxing, of course, as we alluded to earlier. Being able to manage parental emotions and parental behaviors as they, you know, they have difficult relating to their children. I saw in the DSM-5, at least some of the revisions, that they were going to come, they were messing around with this relational disorder, which I think 55% of Americans who are divorced in this country would definitely meet the criteria for. And the biggest thing that Adler talked about, especially for parents and for other people in relationships, is just to accept the imperfections that are present in both parent and child. I mean, we have a difficult time, especially with the advent of mass media, the courage to be imperfect. We sometimes, you know, being imperfect and made it takes a lot of courage. And Adler was the first to really recognize that, yeah, the imperfections in human nature are inevitable. But having the courage to acknowledge those imperfections, and it does take a lot of courage, and Adler was the first to really talk about human existence in that manner. It's incredible.
That's very, very important. I know in my practice, when a parents bring in a child, I will dutifully read the psychological and neuropsychological and educational evaluations. And then I'll explain to the parents that none of them begin with the observation that this marvelous young child, who was so much fun to be with, or in any other way do they begin by acknowledging the grandness, greatness, marvelousness of the child. Instead, right away, they go to picking apart the child's inadequacies and suggesting treatments, from drugs to special educational interventions to fix the child's weaknesses, when that's simply not how life has ever been successfully lived. Life is lived by finding out your strengths and making the very most of them, and the things you love And I encourage these parents to forget about the negative view of what's the matter with your child. Set it aside, put it in a box somewhere, and let's start out with what are your child's strengths? What do you love about your child? What does your child love? And let's build on that, because that's what a successful life is about. It's about finding what you have to give, what your strengths are. Almost inevitably, the things you love or the things you're good at or the things that are going to contribute to society. And it doesn't have to be some sort of perfectly rounded child. It just has to be a child who loves life and there's things that he or she loves to do. And that's so consistent with Adler and inconsistent, of course, with much of psychology and all of psychiatry.
And mental health counseling and even social work. Some of the clinical social work programs are leaning toward that disease model. And we won't even get into what the new consensus for addiction, you know, the NADAC, which, you know, as you know, we've had conversations about the substance abuse realm, which also kind of mirrors what's going on in psychiatry. Broadening the criteria for substance abuse right now, and this is what I just heard in the NADAC newsletter about a couple days ago that I get in the mail, where they're going to just broaden criteria. So everybody's going to get a diagnosis.
Now, you got to tell people, what's the NADAC newsletter?
Oh, I'm sorry. NADAC is National Association for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselors. And, you know, it's kind of like our professional organization for those of us who deal with substance
abuse. So what's happening? Why don't we divert a little bit? I think we're going to be diverting and just having an interesting conversation.
It's our ADHD. I didn't get my medicines today, so.
Yeah.
My Tenex, I didn't get it today, so I'm going to be all over the place.
What's going on with the broadening of the addiction criteria?
Well, when I read the first sentence, I should read it a little bit more thoroughly, but from what I read the last couple months or so, it's just, you know, adding internet addiction and just making, you know, the disease, I would say disease mongering for substance abuse.
Yeah.
Internet addiction, pretty soon they're going to have chocolate addiction. Who knows what they're going to have these days? Television addiction, Twilight addiction for young tweens who watch the Twilight movies. I mean, when will it end? How could it end? And I go back to what Martin Niemöller said in his wonderful essay, you know, when they came for me, there was no one left to stand up. So I just wonder, where is it going to end? I think if you don't have a diagnosis, you're going to be an outlier. And it just reminds me of what Huxley talked about over a century ago, just the control of society. And that's what Adler was talking about in his Will to Power. Power is very, very important. You could talk about money, but power is something that people really crave. One of the most incredible books that I've read over the years is by some Adlerians, and they're out of print, and they're kind of hard to find. But it's by Willard and Margaret Beecher. They were staunch Adlerians, and they wrote a series of books, and one of my favorite ones is The Mark of Cain, An Anatomy of Jealousy. And one of Adler's concepts was talking about jealous competition. You know, people that learn to are more competitive rather than cooperative. And Adler was really more into cooperation, which talked about community. And we see a society today built on competition. You know, we got the Olympics coming up in a few months. You're going to see competition. Out of the 60 athletes that enter a sport, only 3 are going to get medals, and they're going to be rewarded. But just people don't understand. Just getting to the Olympics is an accomplishment, and it depends on how high we raise the bar for people. But I always use a quote from the book of James, James 3:16, where jealousy and self-ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. And I see this in a lot of private practices that I see around town, vying for clients, you know. And it's just the Beechers had this a really wonderful insight on what Adler was talking about, and their books are absolutely fabulous.
I do think that jealousy and envy are among the most guiding principles of human conduct and are very, very destructive. I like to distinguish between jealousy and envy, where jealousy is where you want what your neighbor has and you strive to get it. So you try to get a nice new car too, or you try to improve your house or get your lawn to be greener or send your kids to college. It's not such a destructive phenomenon as envy, which is, you don't even think you can strive to get what your neighbor has, so you'll destroy what he has. You'll burn his house down. You'll puncture right. his tires. You'll pour something into his gas tank. And there's a lot of that in the psychiatric reform movement that you and I are both so, you know, involved in, this attempt to make the mental health profession really based on good, sound principles of personal responsibility and ethics and love. And you'll find within our movement there's so much, not just jealousy, but outright envy, where one leader is trying to take down another leader, or somebody who's not a leader is trying to take down somebody who is a leader, and not working toward the community goal of improving this vast arena we call the mental health arena and making it a better place. And of course, it's very closely related to the will to power, because so much of power yeah. is about envy of other people.
And people, a lot of people seem to think jealousy is it's usually thought of, at least in the colleges, they think of it as an emotion. The Beechers defined it as comprehensive alteration, which distorts the way you feel and act. You know, and it's just, it really creates a discomfort, like you said, a discomfort of our feelings, a disruption, and it really, you know, it restricts our ability to get into the community and act in our community, our communal best interests. It's incredible.
And well, this essential part of Adlerian thinking is how envy or jealousy disrupts human relationships.
Well. Yeah, I mean, and it's been addressed also by Freud. Freud addressed it early on, as did Breyer and some of the earlier psychoanalysts. I mean, Adler also used that as far as jealousy, you know, a concept of jealousy and jealous competition, because it had to do with really the concept of competition versus cooperation. And the Beechers studied with Dr. Alfred Adler, and it's just this. And then they, you know, a lot of people like Dreikers and the Beechers, Edith Dewey, they've taken Adlerian concepts, and a lot of them modernized it, because a lot of Adler's writings weren't available in the U.S. until the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
It's even like with the developmental psychologists, we talk a lot about Piaget. He's widely studied. But people seem to forget a fellow by the name of Lev S. Vygotsky in Russia, who's doing parallel studies like Piaget was on development, zone of proximal development, and his theories didn't really get into the United States until the 1960s. And sometimes some of these hidden gems, it takes a while for psychiatry, as you know, to catch up in psychology and mental health counseling. We're seeing right now, or what I see anyway, is a rash of wellness. A lot of people purporting wellness, but in the same breath that they're, you know, advocating medication on psychiatric medications. It's incredible. You know, in a previous life, as we've discussed, you know, I worked in marketing for many years in the entertainment industry, and it's so funny to see the parallels of healthcare and the entertainment industry. It's no different. It really is no different. At least in the entertainment business, you know that you're going to get hosed one way or the other. In healthcare, you know, we really purport to help people. And I remember a quote from you years ago that I read, psychiatric medications, they make sick people sicker and well people sick. And I've seen this in my 13 years in practice as a psychotherapist here in Florida. You know, well, people that have temporary problems or depression, I always like to define as overwhelming helplessness, and they get on these medicines temporarily and they stay on them for years, and they're just, you know, one of the most incredible concepts that I learned from the Adler, your speak at Adler conference and your conference in April was this intoxication agnosia? Am I pronouncing it right?
Well, yeah. First, it's the lay term is medication spellbinding, and the technical term is intoxication agnosia. That's when you're intoxicated with a drug, that is, you're under its influence, but you don't know it. Anosognosia means you don't know it.
Okay, I've been saying agnosia. I've been pronouncing it wrong, I guess. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
A-G-N-O-S, agnosia.
Intoxication agnosia. Yeah, I've been...
Anosognosia.
Agnosognosia, okay.
There you go.
And why use when people don't understand that, then I go to the medication spellbinding and start...
Medication spellbinding. I describe that in depth in my book, Medication Madness, where I talk about 50 cases in depth of people who committed violence, crime, other weird activities, suicide, under the influence of psychiatric drugs without having the faintest idea that they were under the control of drugs, just thinking that what they were doing was either what they had to do or supposed to do or wanted to do, when in fact they had no idea they were being incredibly destructive to other people or indeed ending their own lives.
When you talk about that, I have a spellbinding effect just listening to it, because the extreme cases like that, and I think you've also mentioned the cases where people are just taking a huge amount of Prozac, 50 milligrams, 60 milligrams, because they always up it from 25 because it never works the month before. They're on these medications. I've had colleagues that are on huge amounts of trazodone, and they come into work and they're just like groggy.
No, oh, yeah, I'm sure they are.
And I'm like, what is going on here? And they can't function until like later in the day when it wears off. And I just think about your concept of medication spellbinding, and my ex-wife was a school teacher and a middle school teacher, and she would have conversations in the teacher's lounge, and these teachers were on Xanax and Prozac and all kinds of these drugs. And I'm thinking, how can they function?
How can they really relate to the children in their care, the children they're supposed to educate? Because one of the first things that all medications do is they interfere with what you're calling social interests.
Yeah.
You know, they always interfere all psychoactive substances, whether it's marijuana or alcohol or psychiatric drugs, they all interfere with what Adler called social interest. That's what our frontal lobes are about. Our frontal lobes evolve precisely to facilitate our social relationships. They were built before we even lived in cities, before we farmed. We had frontal lobes. Before we had technology, we had frontal lobes. And they clearly were for the purpose of our social relationships. And so complex are social relationships that these frontal lobes are powerful enough to do all the other things they've been doing for the past 100,000 years. But it all begins with social relationship, and when you take any psychoactive drug and it immediately starts to impair your frontal lobes and thereby impairs your social interests. And it's one of the first things that families will notice when they have their children or their spouses or other family members on these medications. I think Adler would have been against psychiatric medication.
Oh, no, of course. I mean, because, you know, one of Adler's first tenets was, you know, about the quality of human life. I mean, human qualities are movement toward others. I mean, we move towards others. Adlerian psychology is a psychology of movement. Life is movement. That's what Adler was said many, many years ago. I mean, we move. It's a dynamic interface between others and ourselves. It's relational.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. And you may have heard, I am the conscience of psychiatry. And I'm talking with Thomas Garcia, not a psychiatrist, an Adlerian psychotherapist. He's going for his PhD. He's a licensed mental health counselor in Tampa. Tom, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, they can call me, they can email me. The best way is email. I'm kind of like in my advanced years. I sometimes like prefer email for some reason, but very easy to get a hold of. tgarcia2@tampabay.rr.com. That's tgarcia2@tampabay.rr.com.
And you have a private practice?
I do and I don't. I do a lot of contract work because private practice, you know, and what we do is really difficult to start up. But I've lucked out working with Novus Detox and Suncoast Rehab. Novus is one of the few inpatient medical detoxes that when you walk out of detox, you walk out with probably the shirt on your back and the hat on your head and without any medications whatsoever. I've worked at many detoxes where people get a month's supply of OxyContin. And I kid you not, this is before I've been doing detox almost for about 12 years, and I've seen people walk out with prescriptions for Klonopin, Librium, Ativan, Haldol, Suboxone, Subutex, Methadone, Dilaudid. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. It reminds me of the little song from, Pete Seeger about the lady that swallowed the fly. She swallowed the spider to get the fly, then she swallowed the bird to catch the spider to get the fly, then she swallowed the cat to get the bird. You know, at the end, the fly's been dead for a while, now you have a cat and a bird and a dog in your system. And it's incredible. Novus Detox is a wonderful place out in the middle of Newport Richey, Florida, and we've... what I love about it is that you see the results. People walk out clean. And now, in the true Adlerian sense, now it's time to work on the relationships or the lack of relationships that got you there.
I think that's so incredibly, incredibly important. Do you know, I like AA a lot. I think the principles of AA, they're very ethical principles, they're spiritual principles, they give you a lot of flexibility about the nature of a belief in God, so you don't have to necessarily be a Christian or have an ordinary Judeo-Christian viewpoint. You can participate, but people will be clean and sober from alcohol and be on multiple psychiatric drugs.
It's incredible. It's that intoxication you were talking about.
Yeah, I wish AA would find a way to say psychiatric drugs are also intoxicants, but I don't know how they'd go about taking a stand like that.
Well, like most organizations, it's become very fragmented. And again, from what I've seen over the years working in addictions, is that they just drift from the original principles of what it was founded on. You know, Bill Wilson in the big book called Alcoholism, which to me is a term I don't like using. I never use the term alcoholic or addict. I've never used it in any clinical notes. I yell at students that I supervise for licensure when I hear those terms come out of their mouths because they're not clinical terms. But Bill Wilson described it as a spiritual malady. You know, in the original version of the big book. And it's drifted into when Dr. Silkworth got involved. You know, and rightly so, you know.
When Dr. who got involved?
Dr. Silkworth.
Tell me about that.
I believe in the 1940s, it was more where the treatment of substance abuse, of alcohol, extended use of alcohol. You know, originally the church was involved with treating it. It wasn't really any medical treatment, but it got into the medical community around the 1940s. When rightly so, because you know there are severe complications from withdrawal of alcohol, including seizures. and Dr. Silkworth, who was I think he's one of Bill Wilson's friends that worked with him. He's the one that got alcoholism into the medical community for the medical community to provide treatment. Because before it was just the basements of churches. You know, because the war model of addiction always stated
that. And that's a much better place for it than on the first floor of a psychiatric hospital where everybody's being taught that they give up one drug for another drug because they have a biochemical imbalance, which is certainly no part of AA principles, the big book or the little book or any book in AA. There's nothing in there about substituting one drug for another, nor is there anything in there about a biochemical imbalance. There's one reference, as I recall, to we have an allergy, but all that meant is we just can't handle this drug.
Yeah, so the theories of explanation of drunkenness, this goes beyond AA, even back to the Oxford group in the 1880s. It was a food allergy, but of course, if you have a food allergy to grains, then you would get sick eating breads. There was spirits contained in the bottle. Actually, they believed, honestly, I kid you not, they used to believe that the evil spirits were contained in the bottle itself. And when I was a kid, I worked at a brewery.
Is that where the concept spirits comes from, what you call hard liquor
spirits? I would think so.
My gosh.
That would make sense, but I can't confirm or deny that, but it would make complete sense. It's a good jump anyway. It's a good segue. And I remember working at a brewery when I was a kid, you know, the Schmitz Brewery out in Cleveland, and I used to walk through the warehouse and see the big vats of malt and barley, but I never saw a vat called evil, mean, destructive. I never saw those. So apparently they weren't putting them in. If they did, they were very well hidden. And these explanations of why people use. In fact, around town, I'm considered a substance abuse expert. One of my colleagues came up to me the other day and says, "What's substance abuse counseling?" And you know what? I looked him straight in the face and I said, "Well, I don't know. What is it? You tell me." And they didn't really like my answer. Because, you know, I integrate everything with Adlerian psychology. The first thing I do when I talk to somebody, I ascertain what their relationships are. What are their relationships? You know, and with drug addiction and alcohol addiction, any other type of addiction, they try and find those biochemical imbalances, of course, and the inherited gene. You've heard the story of the rogue gene? They have it for schizophrenia, too. An addiction. It started in the addiction. The rogue gene that sits around your body waiting for something to trigger it. And once it gets triggered, like a rogue, it just goes around your body and all of a sudden you're an alcoholic or an addict. And nothing you could do about it because of biology.
We sure are desperate for those biological explanations.
We
look into. I'd be better off if we were thinking we were possessed by the devil. At least then you could be exercised and be done with it. You can't be done with your biochemical imbalance. It never really gets corrected. It just gets affected by the drug. As long as the drug is there, but of course, the minute you stop the drug, your biochemical imbalance is back.
And that's why I like the work of Stanton Peale. Stanton Peale has been doing, probably he's like your contemporary or your counterpart for the addiction field. He's been talking about advocating against the disease model of addiction, God, since the 1970s. He wrote a book called The Diseasing of America back in the 80s, which kind of shook the foundations. And you know, it's a really nice resource. And it's, if you look at the policies, addiction policies since the 1940s, you could see, just like with psychiatry, you could see the special interest is vested in creating certain policies, especially some of the drugs like Reckitt-Benckiser has literally forced, you know, bamboozled the FDA into approving buprenorphine hydrochloride, which is of course Suboxone, Buprenex, Subutex, And they use that.
Listen, take a minute. Take a minute. Explain what that drug is. This is going to be new for people. Explain Suboxone. Explain how people get licensed to give it, how much money they make with this license, and what it actually does for people, and maybe compare it to methadone. So take a few minutes and do that, would you?
Oh, well, let's see. On the particulars, I know people. I know it's a big money maker. I'm still figuring out. Methadone. I mean, it's a little goodie we got from the Nazis back in after the war. I mean, the military took hold of it first, and you know, methadone clinics, at least one I know in Tampa, they have about 840 clients and charge $13 a dose. So if you do 830 times $13 per day, I can't even imagine the revenue that you get from that.
And it's basically just one more narcotic.
Yeah, oh yes, well they say you can't get high in it, but then people that get take homes, you know, if you behave yourself and you don't test for marijuana and benzos and other drugs, they'll give you take homes. So that way you don't have to line up out the door every Monday morning at 5:30 to get your methadone dose. And this is what Adler talked about, fear, the power. You know, a lot of these organizations, they just create a sense of oppression. I like to call it oppression.
You know, Tom, do you know much about Suboxone? Because that would be an interesting subject. I don't, you know, it's not something I've followed a lot, but, I mean, it's another one of these substitute drugs that people get put on, and doctors have to get separately licensed to dispense it, so then they'd have little local monopolies to dispense it, and they can make a good business that way.
Yeah, when it first started, you know, when I was working at the detox at the hospital back in 2000, you know, we were our doctor was one of four in the area that were qualified to dispense it. We were actually doing the weekly IM version of Suboxone, which is buprenorphine. And they had the shots, not weekly, I'm sorry, I was thinking interferon, excuse me. We were doing the intramuscular injections of buprenorphine. And then, you know, it was still in the trials, the FDA trial, I think the stage 3 trials. And then it got approved, I think around, I would like to say like 2004, 2005, it got approved. And then, of course, SAMHSA was involved in this. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services or Association. I think that's what it's called. I can't remember. I haven't mentioned these names in many years.
SAMHSA is the federal, broke off from the National Institute of Mental Health to be the service branch.
Right.
For mental health when NIMH became the drug company branch for mental health.
Right, and SAMHSA kind of follows along the same lines. I mean, their influence. They were the ones, of course, that were advocating. I remember in your conference in Washington, D.C., watching Karen Efron talk about universal mental health screening and infant mental health, which was something that was SAMHSA's guidelines in 2001.
Can you tell us some more, Tom? Let me bring you back to your clinic, but some of the principles and approaches that work in your clinic and what kind of success rate do you have?
Well, everybody, as far as Novus?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a pretty high, what I mean by success rate, and of course that could be very, that could be very misleading.
I know
people the very few people leave AMA. I would say about maybe 5% of our folks leave AMA, you know, against medical
advice. That's against medical advice without completion of treatment.
Without completion of treatment. And, you know, we use the protocol, our medical doctor is a fellow by the name of Brett Englund, really nice fellow, doesn't believe in psychiatric meds, and really try, you know, because you have to, you know, when you're detoxing, you just can't be like jail or the church basements and just throw them in a room and, you know, hope that they, you know, like in history when you did Bela Lugosi or Ray Charles, you throw them in a room and then they'll go through extreme discomfort. You know, you don't want to do that. And some hospitals, the first hospital I used the Librium protocol, sometimes short-acting benzos, Ativan sometimes. And really we create, and again it goes back to Adlerian psychotherapy, we really create a comfortable, warm, encouraging environment for them to go through this physical discomfort. You know, which sometimes for people in therapy it can be a very horrifying experience, especially if you go to these community agencies where, you know, you just walk into the door and you already think you're in a psychiatric hospital from the 1960s.
Tom, are you using gradual withdrawal approaches? Is it cold turkey?
Yeah, I don't know much on the medical end from there because I don't get too much involved. But it's like they'll detox depending on the amount that you're using, depending on the protocol, and depending how long people are going to stay, because it is a private for profit, and it is a fee for service.
Do you have follow up outpatient services?
No, we recommend treatment centers that we definitely think they're going to work with them and continue the non-drug approach. There's ones that we've used, Transformations in Delray Beach. Suncoast Rehab uses it as well. The kids that we met from Arizona, Sedona, you know, the ones that came to the conference, you know, places like that are going to, because a lot of rehab places, especially when you're dealing with insurances, they have psychiatrists on board, and the minute you get there, they start falling into that SAMHSA-sponsored dual diagnosis, or the new term, of course, is co-occurring disorders, and then they start getting bipolar, not otherwise specified in some of these, you know, these diagnoses, and they fall into that co-occurring disorder. So we got to be real careful about follow-up referrals. But we take care of that, a lot of that from the front end.
Reminds me, Tom, that in the next few weeks or sooner, on our 501c3, on our nonprofit empathic therapy center, we are going to be setting up a resource center where people can give their names and briefly describe their services if they want to be associated with the basic concepts of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. So people go to empathictherapy.org, and you'll see how to get in touch with us. And if you're interested in getting listed as a resource on the empathictherapy.org site, you can let us know, and we'll send you a form to fill out.
That would be incredible. That would be, and that's something I think that's very needed, because some people go for detox and they come out with more medications than they did when they came in.
Yeah,
and then
absolutely.
They go to rehab centers and they get put back on methadone. I've known Suboxone and methadone doctors that specialize in that. People have been sober for 30 days. They put them on Suboxone and methadone. I think that's criminal.
That is. That's reintroducing them to addiction.
Yeah.
Wow.
In fact, at the hospital, our doctor, and you know, he was, because he had a private, you know, once buprenorphine got approved by the FDA for use, and you know, I think doctors had to pay some money and take a little course in order to be able to dispense Suboxone and work with an addictionologist. I think the requirements have lifted since then. But initially, you had to take a course offered by SAMHSA, do an internship with an addictionologist, and pay money, of course, and then you were able to dispense Suboxone. Well, the funny thing is, once it got approved by the FDA, the people who were lining out the doors to dispense it were psychiatrists, at least here in Tampa. And I was amazing to see it. You know, any medical doctor can dispense it, and psychiatrists were the first, like five psychiatrists that I knew in town were lining out the door to take the course and, you know, to start their outpatient Suboxone clinics. I knew a doctor that worked at an inpatient hospital who had his own Suboxone clinic, which was cash money at the time. It wasn't subsidized by the government like it is now. He would cut inpatient stays short at the hospital and referred them to his outpatient cash-only, quote-unquote, treatment. And the treatment, of course, you had to go to one group a week, something like that. It was you know, minimum requirements. I found it criminal. That's one of the reasons I quit the hospital years and years ago, because it was just completely unethical.
What do you see yourself doing in the future? Where do you see yourself wanting to go with your Adlerian work, your detox work?
I'd really like to go overseas. I really like to go to Australia. Something about Australia just intrigues me. Especially when I see Martin speak at your conference. I just get so inspired just listening to him speak about what the wonderful work he's doing down under. And I just see myself going overseas.
Tom is referring to Martin Whiteley, who spoke at our conference for 2 years in a row now, who is a member of Parliament in Western Australia, and who has made Western Australia the only place in the world where the drugging of children is decreasing dramatically. Meanwhile, it's vastly increasing in the rest of Australia. It's funny that you mentioned Australia, because I just spent 3 hours this morning with four Australians who came to interview me for an Australian television coverage of the problem of Xanax, and in part the celebrity deaths related to Xanax, but just in general this widespread epidemic use of this horrifically addicting drug. And one of the four, the interviewer, was a young psychiatrist from Australia, and we quickly became good friends. And I hear changes going on. Here's a young psychiatrist who's not only not frightened of me, but enjoys meeting me and admires my work and is taking some inspiration and looking forward to learning more and more about how to work without drugs. So there are changes going on, and I think Australia is not as bad off, and it's quite as bad off psychiatrically as we are. But psychiatry is always going to be psychiatry. It's going to be this biologically oriented thing. But, yeah, Australia sounds like a wonderful place to go. Goodbye, Tom. I wish you luck in Australia. Never see you again.
Thank you so much. And of course, what I see myself doing is continuing, you know, hopefully to continuing what you started years ago. And I'll go
by
to
the
my
way,
grave
I'm saying
doing
goodbye
it.
Tom, I'm saying goodbye metaphorically. You don't have to leave the show yet.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking, you're off to Australia. And at my age and stage, and me and Ginge, we don't see ourselves traveling to Australia, although we have many friends there, and it just sounds like a wonderful place indeed.
Any place that will have me. My doctorate's going to be in education, so I'm kind of switching gears a little bit more, and that's another story for another topic of education and psychiatry and mental health and how they've blended together since the Goals 2000 and the President's New Freedom Commission of 2003, which thankfully is no longer in effect, thank the Lord. But, you know, I'll go to any place that'll have me. Anybody, and I always tell people, anybody that wants to get better, I can help you.
Tell us a little more.
That sounds arrogant, but if they really want results and they really want to get better, you could do it without psychiatric drugs. You can really do it. People don't believe
it
because
it's
arrogant.
I don't think it's arrogant. I think that success in therapy is determined so much more by the patient's sense of responsibility and determination than anything else. And I think that's the single most important thing, is the patient willing to take responsibility and step up to the plate and look for better principles to live by and do the emotional work of getting past what's ever been in the way of their living the way they know they should live. That many different therapies and many different therapists are going to help. But if the person doesn't want to take responsibility and doesn't want to face up to their own behaviors, the things they need to change, and their way of thinking and how they need to change it, then no therapist is going to help them.
What you asked earlier about Adlerian psychology. You know, not only is it the psychology of movement, but it really purports, and Dreiker's talked about this as well, is the psychology of individual responsibility. You know, Adler said that all behaviors, human actions, are purposive, and, you know, we it's very goal-oriented. And the goals, of course, that Adler talked about was freedom of choice, self-determination, our own individual creativity. It's kind of what they call the teleological principle. And it's not causal. We're active participants in our own destiny. Not only do we react, but we also act, and we act for the better of our whites. And that's something that Adler believed because, and this is something that Eric Erickson talked about, with the absent, once you have the absence of hope, all is lost.
Human beings have purposes.
Yep.
And our purpose can be to take out on others what was done to us, and that's a distorted and not socially positive approach, or we can determine to take our wounds and our injuries and understand ourselves better and feel empathy for those others of us who were wounded, as we all are, and determine to make the world a better place. It's so important, the purposes we choose in our lives. And I really believe we have purposes. I think that any human being can begin to learn about and explore what their gifts and their purposes are. Their gifts and their purposes. And I think that fits very well with Adlerian philosophy.
Yeah, we have to believe that people can change. And if you keep telling people that they're diseased animals, they're bipolar, or they're addicts and alcoholics. I hear clinical people for years, even in my time in the entertainment industry as a marketing and radio person, hearing people use these terms, addict, alcoholic, drunk, dry drunk. These are just these pejorative labels.
Yes.
And it sickens me. Bipolar, ADHD, ODD. What's the
Tom,
new one that's coming up?
We're coming to our end.
Oh, doggone it, the
music.
I want
to thank Thomas Garcia from Tampa, Florida, for being with me today. And everyone who's listening, find your purposes, find your directions, find your gifts and what you can contribute to society. Thank you for listening.
Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.